Wednesday, June 19th, 2019, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley. An ABC News interview with Donald Trump produces several headlines, including a statement that he might not tell the FBI if a foreign government offers him dirt on his 2020 opponents. The president says a New York Times story about Russian and U.S. cyber attacks is treason, and the press secretary who refuses to hold press briefings is leaving the White House. We'll talk about those stories and perhaps a few more in just a moment, but first, let's begin with the fact that President Trump kicked off his re-election campaign last night at a huge rally in Orlando, beginning with an insult for the news media. That was only the first of several rips against journalists, something the president does at every rally these days, and he's done lots of those rallies since his election. Really, it was kind of a repeat of what we've heard on the campaign trail. If you were expecting to hear something new, other than keep America great, there really wasn't much there.
No, it wasn't a whole lot there. I mean, it's pretty much what we've seen from him since he came down the escalator. He has been in campaign mode since he became a candidate. Now he's president and he's still campaigning. I think I read somewhere where he's done, about 60 of these rallies in over the course of the last couple of years. So, I mean, he is the campaign president.
Yeah, I think this has been a permanent campaign. We've talked about this as political reporters, the state of permanent campaign. But if anyone's really solidified that, it's Donald Trump. I covered Bill Clinton, and I thought he loved campaigning more than anybody. But Donald Trump has eclipsed that. He really likes rallies. He likes having foes. So, he hasn't really settled on who his foe is going to be in this campaign. So he's going back to his favorites. The press and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and again, it's nothing new that he attacks the media, shows disrespect for the media, but I thought that last night MSNBC and CNN were pretty happy to dish back that disrespect. I mean, this was the president of the United States announcing his reelection campaign. They stayed with that speech for just a few minutes, and then they cut away to panel discussions and even other topics, while that left Fox News and some online sources as the ones who carried the thing live. And I'm just wondering what you make of the fact that two major broadcast news organizations didn't see fit to stay with the president. I mean, they had his speech in advance, I'm sure, but they decided not to stay with it more than a few introductory remarks.
I'm not really surprised. I mean, I think that the media as a whole, probably with the exception of Fox News and some of the supporting media that are around it, they're going to cover this election differently. They're going to cover Trump a lot differently this time than they did the last time. And I would imagine that there's going to be a lot more, not just from whoever his opponent's going to be, but a lot more critical, more criticism of him and criticism of the way in which he campaigned than we saw the last time.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I do think I would have run with the president's speech a little bit longer. I think with this president, even if you have the advanced text, he is famous for going off the text. I think one of the mistakes we make in the media is to elevate our own discourse above that of the candidates who are running. I think voters really need to know what people are saying. And in this campaign, there are so many new faces on the Democratic side. I think it's really important to give the candidates an opportunity to speak, and then you can do the analysis.
I think, Ernest, when you say that the media are going to cover this election differently, I think they're saying that, mm-hmm. and I hope that's true. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite convinced, and I have a couple of other examples here in a few minutes that'll bring the topic back to us. I do think we ought to examine just how far away from the status quo the media are so far. But CNN and others did some fact-checking, which is somewhat new anyway, and I'm just beginning to wonder whether those fact-checking stories really have the intended consequence, because really it seems to me that the president, just whether he's saying something that is truthful or not truthful, he's very good at manipulating the media to talk about him all the time.
That is one of the things that going back a little bit to what you're talking about, where, you know, he loves to campaign. He also loves to drive the message. He loves to be in control. And in many ways, he and the people around him are really good at finding that one thing every day that will get the media to focus the spotlight on him. They're really good at it, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in this election cycle.
So, Kathy, there's an interesting test of this coming up next week, because the Democrats are having their first presidential candidates debate, and there's a story in the Wall Street Journal that says that Trump plans to live tweet during those debates, and Joe Scarborough over at MSNBC is even saying that the media should not report on Trump's tweets until the next day to give the Democrats room to actually get their message out there. I find it hard to believe that's actually going to happen.
Well, it would be hard to ignore a story like the President of the United States responding in real time to his potential opponents. I think there is a way, though, that you can calibrate your reaction, and you can certainly give the candidates their say, make the president a sidebar or something. I think the dilemma here is, and I think it's, I think Ernest has really pinpointed something. There is a real dilemma, I think, for the news media. Part of the problem is that the president has politicized what we do. Mm-hmm. And so if you, the normal exercise of news judgment becomes then an act that he can critique from a political standpoint. So if you don't report everything he says, well, we're the fake news and we won't give him a break. And if you do, you then become caught in that trap of just letting the president drive the agenda. I think one way campaign reporters could handle this is, I think the focus should really be on the voters this time. And has the president delivered on his promises? To what extent has he delivered on those promises? How are people feeling about that? What do the voters say? What do the numbers say? I think that's one way out of this dilemma.
Well, over the weekend, ABC News ran its exclusive and wide-ranging interview with the president. And in it, he tweaked George Stephanopoulos for questioning his take on the Mueller report.
They gave me questions. I answered them in writing.
Not an obstruction.
Look, George, you're being a little wise guy, okay? Which is, you know, typical for you. Just so you understand. Very simple. It's very simple. There was no crime. There was no collusion. It was a setup. In my opinion, and I think it's going to come out.
Who set
it
up?
I hope it's going to come out. We're going to find out very soon.
You clearly believe there was a group of people working against you. Do you think President Obama was behind it?
I would say that he certainly must have known about it, because it went very high up in the chain. I'm not going to make that statement quite yet, but I would say that President Obama had to know about it.
And that was actually one of the least controversial things the president said in that interview with Stephanopoulos. The most quoted was certainly his assertion that he might take opposition research on his opponents from a foreign government without notifying the FBI. Well, he walked back that statement, sort of, the next day on Fox and Friends, but it still has received an awful lot of media scrutiny.
Well, I mean, one of the things that, because I looked at a lot of the snippets from it, I didn't look at the whole thing, but a lot of the snippets from it, and one thing that really jumped out at me was he is fixated on the fact that there is a conspiracy to get him, and this transcends the Mueller report. I mean, he has to have a foe, and now his foe is not just the media, it's Mueller, it's this shadow conspiracy group of people, whatever. It's always been Obama.
And Hillary.
And so he sort of moves in between these various nefarious actors in creating this narrative that he is the victim.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I was thinking as you were saying this, instead of us calling this the campaign presidency, we might call this the grievance presidency. I've never seen a person who's the most powerful person in the world have, you know, play the victim so consistently that, you know, he's got these terrible dark forces that are going after him. And of course, you know, I think this is classic paranoia. It's the idea when you're a reporter and you're in a newsroom and there's always somebody coming in with some investigative reporter with some idea about a big story, the first thing you say is it possible that all these people from all these different interests and all these different constituencies could possibly be working together in one conspiracy? You know, I know we've all worked in newsrooms. I wish we were organized enough to conspire. We're not. Yeah. And so I think that it strains credulity, but clearly it flies with a lot of people. There were a lot of people in Orlando last night.
You know, I will say, though, that no matter what his mental state about these issues, he seems to know exactly what he's doing.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, for example, you know, despite the controversies or maybe even because of them from this interview that he had with Stephanopoulos, he was actually out there promoting the interview ahead of time. And he said he'll probably do more sit downs with the news anchors in the near future. So it seems to me he's pretty confident in his ability to manipulate us no matter what the message.
But it goes back to the brilliance that is Trump. I mean, he is brilliant at controlling the message. I mean, he knows, he goes, okay, I'm going to be on ABC. I'm going to get the airtime, so I might as well play it to the hilt. And so he promotes it out there to let everybody know, hey, I'm going to be on. I'm not going to tell you exactly what I said, but I'm going to be on and you need to watch. I mean, he's really good at it.
I mean, you never know, of course, when the president's attacks on the media are based on honest anger or he's just doing them for effect. But he seemed genuinely upset with a story this week in the New York Times. It detailed how his cyber warriors are pushing back on the Russians who've been hacking our power grid by doing the same thing to them. The Times said that some members of Trump's administration didn't want him to know about it because they worried he might nix the program or even tell the Russians. On the other hand, that story also noted that there was a law passed by Congress as well as a presidential directive from Trump himself that gave the military the option of carrying out these cyber activities without giving him all the details. Regardless, Trump labeled that Times story treason. And Kathy, you wrote an opinion piece for USA Today about that claim. So why don't you start our discussion about that?
Well, I think, you know, I think the president has a tendency to project. You know, when somebody accuses him of being fake, he jujitsus, and as you said, a very brilliant way, and says, you're the fake ones. If somebody says he's failing, he says, you're the failing ones. So here he's saying that the New York Times is committing treason when, in fact, the story suggests, you know, maybe not quite treasonous, but that some of the people in his administration are sufficiently concerned about the president's maybe not loyalty, but at least his self-restraint, that they don't want to talk to him about some of these operations. And I think that is why he was so angry. The story itself made it pretty clear, and actually there's a lot of logic to this, that the people who were behind the cyber, these anti-cyber hacks, the retaliation against the Russians, actually want the Russians to know. Right. And that's classic deterrent strategy. So I think, again, it strains credulity to think that the New York Times was doing anything but running with what government authorities wanted them to, and it was the president who was out of step here.
Well, and in fact, as you noted, and as the Times reported in its story, he asked, one of the reporters for the piece asked national security officials in the Trump administration whether they had any problems with the story, and they said that they really didn't have any. So that seems to answer that question. But just using the word treason, that's dangerous.
I mean, he's taken it to another level. I mean, he's not the first president that's been upset when a media outlet has presented a story that they deem to be a threat to national security. You've always had this, since the founding of the Republic, you've always had this tug of war between freedom of the press and threat to national security, and it goes back and forth. This is one of the few times where a president has openly said that what the media has done in terms of New York Times has done is as a treasonous offense. And I think, again, this is classic Trump taking it to another level and really pushing the boundaries.
Well, and I think what pushes the boundaries and what makes it scary is there's a lot of anger, and he's playing to that anger. You mm-hmm. saw it in the clip from the rally, and you know, this story broke while I was at the Investigative Reporters and Editors Convention, and we were at a lunch where Rick Hutzel, the editor-in-chief of the Capital Gazette, spoke, and there were people, you know, really blinking back tears in a room of hard-bitten journalists, because he was talking about what it was like for him and his colleagues to try to come back after a mass shooting. Now, you know, five people were killed in that newsroom a year ago. Do we know if there was a connection? No, but we do know that adding fuel to this fire, this kind of dangerous rhetoric, is not something the leader of our country should be doing at a time like this.
Well, we've been talking about the president's words so far, but the person who's officially responsible for Trump's messaging to the media is Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and she announced this week that she's stepping down at the end of the month.
It's truly the most special experience. The only one I can think of that might top it just a little bit is the fact that I'm a mom. I have three amazing kids, and I'm going to spend a little more time with them. And in the meantime, I'm going to continue to be one of the most outspoken and loyal supporters of the president and his agenda. And I know he's going to have an incredible six more years and get a whole lot more done.
Needless to say, Sanders has a different relationship with Trump than most previous press secretaries have had with their bosses. The president even called her up on stage in Orlando last night, and he's pushing her to run for governor of Arkansas. She's also had quite a bit of a different relationship with journalists than past press secretaries.
Yeah, I don't know if relationship is the right word. I mean, the fact that
anti-relationship.
Yeah, it would probably be better. I mean, you know, she has basically done away with the White House press briefing. I mean, it is gone. And it's going to be interesting to see whether or not it's going to come back, not just in this administration, but future administrations. I mean, and her ability to be able to get up in front of a microphone and to flat out lie on behalf of this administration is, again, one of those remarkable things about Trumpism, because she was able to do it. I mean, to the point where initially it was just saying, well, she misspoke or this sort of thing. Toward the end, you had journalists basically saying, oh, no, she's just lying.
Well, and there's an interesting piece on our Links blog from The Atlantic, and it's called Sarah Sanders Broke the News. And in that piece, the author writes, she's deflected, she is belittled, she is eye-rolled, she is condescended, she is obfuscated, she is misled, she is lied, and she has treated it all as a battle to be won. Is that last sentence really kind of encapsulating the difference between Sarah Sanders' sort of strategy with the media, that it's a battle to be won at whatever cost?
Well, I think she's very much reflecting her boss. I think that's a thankless job. The press secretary's job has always been a really tough one in the White House because on the one hand, you've got a boss who wants to control the message. On another, you're in front of journalists every day who want a story, so it's never been a great job to have. But I can't imagine a worse job than doing this for Donald Trump, whose relations with the truth and with the media are so problematic.
Does it really matter who replaces her, since the president believes he is his own best spokesman?
I'm not sure about that, Mike. I think about it, and I go, he may not, as he seems to have done for the last 6 months to a year in terms of replacing other people, it'll be an interim. It'll be someone who goes in, and if he feels like they're not on message with him, he'll just figure out a way to get rid of them and bring somebody else in. He is his own best messenger, so he probably will trot it out that way.
I agree.
Well, I think it's fair to say that you're rarely going to find President Trump on the same proverbial page with Washington Post media writer Margaret Sullivan. She's been very critical of him, but they did appear to agree on at least one thing this past week, that news organizations are making a big mistake relying on early polls to drive their campaign coverage. Trump actually said he's winning everywhere, according to his own pollsters, which seems pretty unlikely. But Sullivan also called out reporters for anointing Joe Biden as the Democrats' front frontrunner this early, and she says that poll-driven coverage is cutting off the oxygen for Biden's primary opponents. Is that a fair criticism?
I think it is a fair criticism. I think it's way too early to be looking at polls. I mean, even the ones that came out showing that the president is in trouble in a lot of key battleground states, and which precipitated him firing his pollsters, that's even too early. I think she has a point here. What I'm going to find interesting, especially in this upcoming debate, is how are you going to have this many people in a debate where you have debate A, debate B, you've got this group of people talking in this room and this one and the other. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens after this. Does the field of candidates on the Democratic side gets whittled down to where you begin to see some sort of clear picture as to where they're going? They may be even too early for that.
I agree with you, but I want to stick, Kathy, for just a moment on this whole question about polling, because that was one of the biggest criticisms of 2016 coverage. And here we are already saying this candidate's a front runner. Here's the order of the people going to be on the stage for the debate. And I just wonder if we're going to learn anything, have learned anything from those mistakes of last time.
Well, I think it's hard. It's difficult in defense of the political writers and the debate organizers. You know, you don't have much else to go on at this point other than early polls. And I don't think anyone is anointing Joe Biden as the nominee at this point. People have learned that lesson from the 2016 campaign when Hillary was supposed to be the anointed nominee and Bernie gave her a very good run for the money. So I think what will happen is that in these debates, different candidates are going to rise or fall, and that will fuel fundraising for a lot of these candidates, and that will or dry up fundraising for a lot of these candidates. So the early debates, especially for those candidates who are seen as back of the pack, become very, very important, because whether they can score enough points and get enough traction to get the funding to get them to the next landmark in the race, I think, is going to be the big question.
Well, you know, the other thing too is, it's to me, when it comes to the polling, the interesting thing is going to be, are you going to listen to the polls or are you going to listen to the people? Because we in the media spent a lot of time listening to the polls in 2016, and we didn't see what was happening out in some of these areas in terms of what people actually did when they got into the voting
booth.
Yeah,
and part of that, I think, again, comes into a budgetary thing. You know, we've talked in the past about newsrooms being hollowed out. Well, it's a lot cheaper to have a couple of people sitting in a studio or in a newsroom crunching polls than it is to actually send them out on the road to talk to people in places like Missouri.
That's because we're suckers for a simple narrative,
right,
first of all. And I think it's going to allow both the Democratic front runner, whoever that turns out to be, and Trump to just lead us around by the nose again, if we're not really careful about, again, focusing on the voters and what they need. Well, we talked last week about doctored images and so-called deepfake videos and audio clips. Played a couple for you. Well, there's a new study out by the Pew Research Center, and it says that Americans, Democrats, Republicans, independents, doesn't matter, we're all worried about the impact of those fakes. 6 in 10 adults say that it's asking too much for the average American to discern what's real and what's not. And 3/4 of us say that we want someone, whoever that would be, to restrict access to them. I'm just wondering, I think the anxiety is real, but saying somebody ought to do something about it, what can that something be?
That's a $10,000 question. What could that something be? And who's going to be responsible for this? I think this is the question that I asked last week when we talked about this is, who are you going to hold responsible for doing it? Is it going to be the government? Is it going to be the tech companies? Are there going to be actual laws that are going to, you know, criminally go after someone, or is it going to be handled in a civil manner? It's, you know, I understand the problem and I understand the issue. It's just, how do you solve this once it's already happening, once the genie is out of the bag?
Well, I actually think that poll is really healthy. It's a sign of healthy skepticism on the part of the public, and I think it's good that people are aware of and worried about this. You know, traditionally, it's been publishers who have taken the responsibility to ensure accuracy, and sometimes not, on their platforms. So that may be one answer, and that would include tech companies. But I think the other answer is education. I think the more people know about the extent of this phenomenon and how it can happen. And the more people think to themselves, take a deep breath, check it out before I pass it on, the better off we're going to be as a democracy.
Yeah, I agree, because one of the things in this survey that I always find interesting, and this comes up in topics other than this one, the people who were surveyed thought they can identify fake images while other people really can't. And I'm not so sure that that's true.
Right.
Well, so our last topic of the day is a story that you don't see every day. Norman Perlstein is the executive editor of the Los Angeles Times, and that means he's ultimately responsible for what appears in the news pages of his paper. News editors typically draw a bright line between their responsibilities and those of opinion writers, but Perlstein has written a very personal op-ed describing how his girlfriend and ex-wife had what was back then an illegal abortion during their freshman year in college. He says that he wrote the column because of efforts by several states to push the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. Now, it's not our job on this show to insert ourselves into the abortion debate per se, but I wonder what you think about Perlstein as an editor of a paper deciding to do that.
I thought it was in many ways courageous on his part to do that. I don't know. I'm not quite sure whether or not it was the right thing to do. I can understand that you want to have some, at least in this case, he wanted to be able to have some sort of a say in where this is going, and use his ability to be able to do that from his newspaper. I don't know. I think the jury is still out on whether or not we've gotten to the point where we can do these kinds of things in the media and be able to actually affect change.
Yeah, I hear what Ernest is saying. I think certainly he felt passionately about this, and that's important. It's not unheard of for an editor of a news organization to take a stand on an important issue. On the other hand, it does put his reporters in an awkward position. If they're doing interviews, how can sources be sure that they're going to get a fair shake from the LA Times?
Yeah. I worried a little bit, too, because as you would expect, people who have different views about abortion were coming back in the comment section of the Times and pointing out, well, you two were pretty privileged going to Ivy League colleges when you were freshmen. You had a lot of resources behind you to make this decision. And so maybe the moral implications of it weren't that front and center for you.
I mean, I wonder if he could have handled that more as in a news angle way, a news story way, as opposed to coming at it the way he did. But then again, I mean, it's his choice as his newspaper. So,
well, we could obviously spend an entire hour talking about abortion and how it's covered in the news media. Maybe we'll get around to that if we're crazy, because we know what kind of attacks we'd get from all sides if we did. But that's going to do it for today. We're out of time for this week, and I want to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we talked about today. Just go to our links blog. You can find it under the programs and the podcast tabs, either one of those, at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are great ways to watch and listen to our program again if you'd like. You can also leave us comments or questions and see previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Aaron Hay for handling our audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Mike McKean. Join us again next week when Amy Simons returns with a new edition of KBIA's Views of the News.